A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that on Tuesday's podcast, Jack Howard and I started our rundown of our top five underrated films list. The conversation went on for longer than usual, so we decided to split the podcast into two. So on Tuesday's podcast, we did numbers 5 to 3. And in this podcast, we both pick up with our top two underrated movies. So sit back and enjoy Jack Howard and I discussing our favourite underrated films.
Right, my next choice is... Which one should I do first? I'm going to do this one first. I'm going to say The Mask of Zorro.
Wow, okay, go ahead.
The Mask of Zorro is a film that's been with me for as long as I can remember. And I think it's one of those action movies that kind of... I don't know, change things without... sort of quietly change things without people even noticing.
What year is it, Jack? What year did it come out?
I think it was 1997, but I'm going to check that.
So how old would you have been when you saw it? Like 3?
1998, damn it.
Okay.
I would have been 6 when this came out.
Okay.
But I never saw it in the cinema. My dad got it for me on video. Because when I was a little boy, I was obsessed with James Bond.
Yes, you've told us about it. You've told us about it. Yeah.
Extent. And so my dad was starting to sort of like filter my movie taste with other things in a similar genre. So he showed me Terminator 2, Mask of Zorro, etc., etc. Coincidentally, The Mask of Zorro is directed by Martin Campbell, who directed GoldenEye and Casino Royale, two of the best Bond films ever. And I remember from the opening of the movie, I was like, I'm going to love this. Because the opening is essentially a James Bond film. He walks out, not unlike the gun barrel, and does the big Zorro Zed. Like James Bond shooting at the camera. And there's just from the opening, there's just this great sense of adventure and excitement and old-fashioned, I don't know, like this. You don't see stuff like this anymore, like real stunts and sword work and all the rest of it, but also, like, I don't know, like a hero on the right side. So here's what I'm going to say about this.
Okay.
It's a soft reboot before they were a thing.
Okay.
It works as a continuation of Zorro, and reinvents what Zorro is in the way that Star Wars has tried to do. Because Zorro has always been obviously the Bruce Wayne type. It obviously was Bruce Wayne before Bruce Wayne, but the rich guy who wants to help the poor. And this reimagined version of Zorro is passing the torch on to somebody who is a man of the people. He isn't above them and coming down to help. He is an actual... He was an orphan and a criminal and somebody who existed amongst the other people and then decided... And he is the new Zorro.
Yeah.
And he gets to take up that mantle now. So just even as a retelling of Zorro, that is just incredibly progressive before anybody else was doing it.
Yeah.
But the movie has got so much... It's got such a voice. It's unlike anything else that I've seen. It feels like it fits alongside other swashbuckling films, but actually it's nothing like them. It's really funny. It's really romantic. It's a very sexy film. I don't know if you remember how, like... Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones, the heat between them, the dance scene that they have, the scene where they essentially have a sex scene, but it's a sword fight and they're just undressing each other. And it's just very awakening for 12-year-old me. But but also just like there's a passion to it and a heat to it that just doesn't exist in movies that were made because it's a family movie.
Yeah.
But like you don't get that sort of stuff these days. Everything's very, I don't know, like... I know sexuality and all that sort of stuff is kind of removed from, especially like the big movies that come out now.
Yeah.
And the central performances in it are amazing. Yeah, you have to overlook the fact that it's about Mexican people and there are no Mexican people in it. But it's a different time, you know, 1998, they didn't do that. But it's a really fun movie and doesn't get talked about enough. I think it's just super fun.
I think the remarkable thing is, I mean, I saw it when it came out. I was the film critic at Radio 1 at the time, and I have very little memory of it.
I
remember it being fine. I don't remember thinking this is great. I remember thinking it was okay. I was actually just looking online to see whether there's anything about my, you know, whether I managed to review it anywhere. And I did a review for Radio 1. I think I was broadly positive, but nothing other than, oh, here's a movie, it's fine. And hearing
I think it's probably stood the test of time.
Hearing you talk about it makes me want to go back and revisit it now, because it sounds like a much more memorable movie. I mean, funnily enough, when we were doing Secrets of Cinema about superhero movies, and that thing about Zorro and, you know, Batman and Bruce Wayne was something that we talked about, but because the old incarnations of Zorro, I haven't watched that version of Zorro since it came out in 1998 when I was at Radio 1. So at Radio 1, I said, my voice went off funny, when I was at Radio 1, and so I should go back and look at it again, particularly as well. I mean, it sounds to me like you had a reaction to it similar to the reaction that I had when I was 6 years old going to see Krakatoa: Reast of Java, when I just couldn't.
Sure.
I just literally couldn't believe what was going on screen. There was stuff, and there was singing, and it was volcanoes, and there was balloons, and it was sexy, but I didn't know why, because I was six, mm-hmm. you know, and It's got
a real Spielberginess to it as okay. well, like The Mask of Zorro. There's a bit at the beginning in the opening scene, which was Spielberg's idea, where three innocent men are about to be killed, and then Zorro whips the last gun and then pulls them all to fire somebody else. And
right.
It's just like such a Spielberg moment, and there's so many like fun, playful bits of cinema. Something that we don't bring up enough on this, we kind of forget because we get pulled in by the visuals and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But the music in The Mask of Zorro is by James Horner, and it is incredible. It's so big, and it's just the way that the guitar twangs whenever there's a Zorro moment in it. And there's like a few. What the one that sticks out is when Antonio Banderas is getting the proper mask for the first time,
right?
And how it holds off. Like it really. It's almost the way that Spielberg teases the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. Like he makes you wait and wait for the satisfaction of seeing them for the first time. He makes you wait to see Zorro for the first... Like, you get Zorro at the very start, and then you don't get him again until, like, an hour later or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the moment when Antonio Banderas sees Anthony Hopkins drop the mask and the music goes... Diddling, like, it's just, like, it gives me goosebumps just to even, like, oh, it's happening, we're going to get Zorro. And it does all that wise old... you know, Jedi stuff that The Last Jedi does before The Last Jedi. And, you know, it's all this, like, old samurai type thing. It's just a frigging fun time.
Okay, I'm going to go back and see it. And incidentally, I do a film music show on Scala Radio, and I'm going to play some of that score, because now that you've mentioned that, I'm going to play some of that score, because I had actually...
Nice.
I haven't thought about it since 20 years. So, okay, very good choice, very good choice.
Slow! Attack slow. Attack! Slow. Again. Slow. First triangle. Slow. Like good. Good. That is good.
Thank you.
Attack. Good. Time for a drink.
So now, my next choice, and I don't know whether you've seen this or not, is the Hughes Brothers' Dead Presidents, which for me is...
I watched it last night.
Oh, okay. So can I begin by saying to you, you tell me what you thought, because I have been flying the flag for Dead Presidents since it came out, and I think it's such a great film, and the soundtrack is... Tell me what you think.
It really struck a chord with me. I it was really emotional, and
good.
It feels like a combination of Full Metal Jacket and Goodfellas. Like it's not unlike Don John shifts genres. Like it starts out as like a drama romance and becomes a full on war film, and it's not shying away.
The Vietnam sequence, which is short but horrific.
Oh, oof, just overwhelming. Like just, I can't remember what the actor's name is, but the guy who chops off somebody's head.
Yeah.
Like, good God, like, terrifying. And then going back to, like, it really lets you stay in those moments. And so then when it transitions into the next genre and into the next portion of that person's life, you do, as the audience, question, how do we go from one thing to the other?
Yeah.
How is that possible? And you question that for the character as well. I thought it was really effective. I thought it was a bit dated. It was very 90s.
Okay.
Very 90s in the way that it was told. It was very, like, I don't know how else to describe it other than it was very movie about it. Like, some of the moments are very, like, they're movie scenes. They're not trying to create a moment, but they're like good movie. The transition as well from him running through gardens into the war is just perfect.
So when we did, so here's what I think about it. I think you're absolutely right about the fact that it shifts genres, and it's basically it's a coming of age movie that turns into a Vietnam War movie that then turns into a kind of Goodfellas style crime heist movie. And in fact, we used it in the Secret of Cinema program, which was about heist movies, which they've recently repeated on BBC4. They're playing all the old ones again, because we just did a new series and they're playing all the old ones, which is great, having them back on the thing. And because it begins and ends with a heist, and we begin in the truck where the heist is about to happen, and then we flash back and we see all the events that got us to this place. And then it becomes this coming of age story with Lawrence Tate's central character, like you say, a romance and a brilliant evocation of the time. And then he goes to see his girlfriend, and then he runs through the back gardens because, you know, he's being chased out of the house, and we cut from him running through the back gardens, bang, to him running in Vietnam. And I think that cut is just, that was the moment at which I thought, okay, the Hughes brothers, because I'd seen Menace to Society before, which of course had been a big fuss. People won't remember this now, but there was a big fuss about Menace to Society being released on video, because there was a whole thing about, oh, it's going to inspire crime, and it shows you how to break into a car, and you know, and it got a kind of quite an edgy reputation. But Dead Presidents, the scope of it, you know, the kind of the storytelling scope of it, which is, I think, what you mean when you say Goodfellas, because Scorsese was a big influence for the Hughes brothers. And then it comes back, and then it comes back to this heist. It is about the heist that then, you know, everything that goes wrong with it. And I thought, firstly, just as a confident piece of broad canvas filmmaking, it was wonderful. I thought the way in which they understood the soundtrack was very Scorsese, that the placement of all those songs was perfectly done. But the best
thing... Danny Elfman's score as well.
Yeah, but the best thing about it is that it's that demonstration that when movies work, they put you inside the mind of a character with whom you have very little in common, and you basically invest in that character and you become that character. And I just think that you follow that central character's arc all the way through that movie. And when you get to the end, the courtroom scene at the end, when Martin Sheen suddenly turns up as this kind of
sanctum. I was like, what?
I know, but that's great, because it just tells you once again that Martin Sheen is the kind of person who would go, this is a good film, I am going to lend my cameo to it because it deserves me, because they are really good filmmakers. And I interviewed them. They went on to make other stuff, you know, both together and separately. And I interviewed them for radio, again, when I was at Radio 1. And I remember everyone was talking about Spike Lee, who's, you know, Spike Lee's a great filmmaker, but no one was talking about the Hughes brothers. And I did think about the Hughes brothers in the same way that I thought about the Wachowskis when I first saw their stuff, is, wow, this is, or the Coens, you know, this is a singular voice coming from two filmmakers who are just telling one story so powerfully. And,
it is unlike anything else I've ever seen. Like, I can't say I've seen a film quite like it.
I just think it's people were talking then a lot about, you know, New Black Cinema, and I was thinking, this is it. This, you know, that. And again, unfortunately, it hasn't had the recognition that it deserves, because it is tough. I mean, the Vietnam sequence is really brief. Incidentally, Michael Cimino fans, you want to do a tough Vietnam sequence, Dead Presidents. And that Vietnam sequence is like 20 minutes long tops. It's not like The Deer Hunter, which goes on for 5 days and has got the fucking Russian roulette sequence in it. And then Cimino going, oh, yeah, it's based on my own experiences. Yeah. Anyway.
It's Bokeem Woodbine
Bucky Woodbine's the guy. Yeah, he does the thing, and
he's the guy who chops the head off
And then puts it in and carries it in his bag. And then Laren Tate is the central character. Who's I mean, he
as well. His character I thought was fascinating. That when he like his transition back to life after war, like all of that is fascinating and has been explored in other films as well. And I never don't find that harrowing and interesting to see that Chris Tucker's character turned very hard to drugs. And
incidentally, isn't that the best Chris Tucker performance you've ever seen? Because Chris Tucker can be really annoying.
I'm quite a fan of Chris Tucker.
But he can be really annoying.
He can
but
be
he's
annoying.
Great
he,
yeah. in Dead Presidents.
He's really, really good in this. And his transition, and then Bokeem Woodbine's, like, almost, I almost, again, it's like the stuff that you don't see. Like, you cut to him after war, and he hasn't been on screen since you saw him with a person's head in his backpack.
Bag, yeah.
And now he's a preacher, and he's fully, like, you know, given his life to God.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like he went, I will repent for all this, and I'll be okay. It didn't feel like he had any other option.
And it
felt like he was a completely different person.
Yeah.
And I found that transition interesting, and the fact that his, you know, the main character's girlfriend was this almost archetypal virgin when he left, and when he comes back she's implied to be a prostitute, and it's like that, how much stuff can change, and the expectations on him as a man to yeah, all the constant like going to get a real job, and she even says, I think, directly to him, like, bring in some money and get a real job like a real man,
or something like that.
It's just,
and there's the whole thing about who's been looking after her while he's been and all that. It is that coming of age, rites of passage, death of innocence, but brilliantly
and it's sad.
Done.
Like what you were saying really about sad. that courtroom scene, the last thing that happens, like throwing the chair at the judge and saying, "After everything I did for this country, this is what I'm getting."
Yeah.
And then he gets taken away, and it fades to black, and that's it.
And can I just say that's
such a downer?
That scene is so perfect. We used that to end the Secrets of Cinema program about heist movies. The Secrets of Cinema actually ends with that thing because I think it's one of the best endings ever. You know, I just think
it gives you a real sense of like leaving me with a feeling.
Exactly.
Don't even answer that shit. No, you're right. I ain't gonna answer it. I mean, shit. You, Anthony, you the big Marine man with no damn job. You know every fucking thing. But answer this for me. If you think I'm jiving you so much, Anthony, why the hell are you with me, huh? Why the fuck you with me? What, you think I need you? You think I need this shit? Fuck, you can't get a decent job. You won't fuck me. The only time I get to hold you is when you're having one of them silly ass nightclubs.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. You don't know, girl. You really don't know.
Don't you fucking walk away from me.
You better get the fuck off of me.
Don't walk away from me, Anthony.
Let me go.
What about that?
I'm gonna kill you, girl. Don't you ever run up on me, ever. Ever run up on me again. I'll fucking kill you, Juanita! Fuck off me!
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Your last choice, Jack. Come on, impress me.
My last choice. And I have saved this for number one.
Okay.
Because it's, I think it's a massively underrated film. I never hear anybody talk about this.
Go ahead.
It is Boy A.
Yeah.
Which is an Andrew Garfield starring performance before he was the Andrew Garfield we know now. It's a British film. And again, it was interesting to I saw this film at a younger age. I wasn't young, but I was certainly like a formative years when I was developing my taste in cinema. And it is very sad. And exploring what it's about was interesting to me to discover what it was. I don't know if I should. I kind of want to say.
Well, I think I think you have to say a little bit about. The title tells us something that we.
There is a. A case of two boys who committed a crime of sorts, and this is about the boy who is now grown up, his going back into society after what he did when he was a kid.
And boy A and refers to the way in which they were referred to during the court case in order to preserve their anonymity, and that
and so he's struggling now to sort of go back into normal life and to keep that anonymity, and it's hard. It's a hard watch, but it's also a really beautiful film. It's shot by Rob Hardy, who shot Ex Machina and Mission Impossible Fallout. Right. Like, this was one of his earlier films, and you can tell it's the same. It's shot. Some of the shots are like burned into my brain. It's so beautifully photographed, and Andrew Garfield's central performance in it is really great. It's also got Peter Mullen in it, who is, I find, always a charming British presence. I don't know what else I can say about it, because it just feels like it's one that you should discover as you're watching it, because it's definitely pulling on the strings of real life cases like this that have happened, and such a taboo subject, and an interesting subject to explore in terms of like a character and what that would do to a person. Yeah, and again, quite a sad one.
My memory of this is, I didn't see it in the cinema. I saw it on television, and I had always assumed for some reason that it was actually made by or for television. I mean, it does come up as a film, but I definitely saw it at home, not in a screening room. And I remember thinking that Andrew Garfield, who I did give a Kermode Award to...
For Social Network.
Yeah, well, wow. Well, remember, Jack.
I remember everything about The Social Network.
I'm just astonished that, he got one of these.
So one of those should be in a cabinet somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember thinking with Boye, he is really good, because that is a really hard role to play. And the reason it's hard is because it's to do with that strange thing about sympathy and distance, with the difference between empathy and sympathy, the difference between understanding and accepting a character. And all those things have to be carried all the way through the film. And as you said yourself, this is a very sensitive subject. We're not giving away any sort of spoilers or anything about this, but it is dealing with a very, very sensitive subject. And right from the title, you know, Boy A, which, of course, if you're my age, you know, Child A, Child B, Boy, these are associations with horrendous things that happened in the fairly recent past in the UK. That even from that title, you're kind of we're on awkward ground here. And I think the thing that Garfield manages to do is to keep you on that awkward ground all the way through the film.
I think it's because he plays there's such an innocence and childlike nature to him, because he hasn't experienced anything, because he hasn't had a normal, he hasn't had a normal growing up life. And everything that he experiences in this film, that everybody, so people are like confused by him and don't understand why he hasn't done or why he acts certain ways. And there's a scene that I really remember, that's in a club where he dances and is free for the first time. And is like, I don't know if he's on drugs or anything. I think he might be. I think he might take drugs for the first time. And there's just this like very freeing moment where he's just dancing on his own. And there's something very, I don't know, freeing about it, watching him do it. Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I've been meaning to rewatch it. And when I thought about underrated films, this was the first one that came to mind that I don't think enough people have seen.
Interestingly enough, I looked it up in terms of, it was critically very well received. It was taken to be great. particularly for Garfield's performance. So
he won a BAFTA TV award for his performance.
Yeah, so that okay. So if he won a BAFTA TV award, then it must have been. I must be right in that it was made for television, which is why I remember seeing it on TV. But you're right, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it since it came out. I remember being really struck by Andrew Garfield in it and thinking he is really good because everything about that drama is edgy. Everything about it, you never settle into it. You always, you know, so which I think is a really terrific balancing act. Okay, that's a great.
And also, it's directed by John Crowley, who went on John Crowley, who went on to direct Brooklyn.
Oh right, yeah, which is a great film, yeah. So yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, which is a really, really great film.
As you know, well, there are certain provisions regarding your release.
I do.
There's quite a few, in fact, so we've been playing it.
Jeff.
What?
That's the name I want.
Okay. Jack. Now that's the first thing taken care of.
Okay, so I've kind of done the same thing about saving this till last. Is Grace of My Heart, and anybody who's a regular listener will know that I go on about this all the time. Grace of My Heart is the movie that kind of got overlooked because it sort of came out around the time as That Thing You Do. And it is a film that is inspired by, but crucially not based on, the Carole King story. It's about a young singer-songwriter who starts earning her living working in the Brill Building with a guy with whom she is partnered, who then becomes her, you know, her husband, and then their relationship falls apart. And it goes through all these different periods of the evolution of pop music, and it kind of weaves a strange semi-fictional narrative through the Beach Boys and through girl pop and then, as I said, if you know the Carole King story, you can see the places where it weaves in and out of the truth. Brian Wilson, Dennis Wilson, you know, the Svengali character, the character played by John Turturro, who specifically isn't Phil Spector. In fact, at one point actually says, not Phil Spector, because he kind of is, but he kind of isn't. And I have seen that film so many times, and it's got all these brilliant songs that were all written as if they were songs written from the time in the Brill Building. And then as if they were written, you know, when Carole King was writing Tapestry. And there are great composers, you know, Bacharach and Elvis Costello and Louise Goffin. And I just think it's up there with Slade in Flame as the great unsung pop fictional history movie, and I just think it's a work of genius, and it just didn't do any business at all. And for ages you couldn't even get it on DVD here. It's only recently that it's been available. Please tell me that you liked it.
I hated it.
Oh, Jack! No!
No. I'm sorry to say.
Oh God!
It was really bad. Okay. I don't want to burst bubbles, but I have opinions.
You go ahead. Okay. Nothing you can say will burst this particular bubble
you.
For me.
No, yeah. No, that's fine. From the beginning, I was like, okay, this is all a bit on the nose. Like the mom saying, "It's you who doesn't fit." I was like, all right, okay, so this is the story we're getting. And just to sort of track the mum's story, I really hated how it ended up. I hated that at the end she became massively successful, and then the mum looked at her record, and the story sort of finished on her being like, okay, I'm satisfied, I'm happy for her. She got what she wanted. And I was like, you weren't there for any of it. Why do I care about what you think? Like that bothered me. I thought John Turturro was excellent. I thought he was such a great presence in it. The whole thing felt like it was a little bit theatrical. Like, everything was a little bit, I don't know, like, the bit when she's like, you got the last copy of the song? And like, it was all just a bit, I don't know, just a bit cheesy and a bit on the nose. The everything was a bit sort of one-dimensional and simplistic. Like, everyone just says exactly how they feel at every moment of the film. There was a bit of a soap opera storyline. Like, your husband is jealous of his talents, and now you're having a baby, and now he's cheating on you. And I hated the way that was revealed. Like, you revealed it was badly edited. Like, and it's Thelma Shoemaker, I think is her name. But it was edited by three different people.
Yeah.
But that moment when you find out that her husband is cheating on her is badly cut. Like she's about to go into her house, and then it shows them in bed, and then it shows our protagonist walking in. And I was like, no, you've broken the perspective.
Thelma? Yeah, I'm talking to Jack Harrod.
Tell her from me.
He thinks you edited that scene really badly. And he's got some tips from you. Yeah, no, he's a big, important director. Yeah, no, I know, no, seriously, he's got some good tips for you. I'll pass it on.
There's a lot of continuity errors as well in Shutter Island. Let her know that. Yeah, I thought it was just all clunky, and something that really, I think the point
Jack.
That really, really Jack. Annoyed me, and genuinely this is the point that I was like, okay. this is rubbing me the wrong way,
okay.
is Matt Dillon, who is just bad in it,
and he's not, but
his character is...
Can I just say, what kind of criticism is it?
Go on.
He's just bad.
He is...
That's like
when you're looking at it, when I read this
Shakespeare play, and it was boring. I don't like
Matt
King
Dillon,
Lear because he dies at the end.
It feels like Matt Dillon doesn't know what film he's in.
Oh, for
and it feels like the director hasn't told him how he's supposed to be feeling when things are happening. I also think his storyline is completely underwritten, and the representation of depression is simplistic and makes no effort to actually understand him. He is just a prop who has depression. He's then sat in a room. Somebody comes in and tells him, come on, man, pick it up. And then... he commits suicide, and then that's just part of the story. It's just like it is just hung there as a narrative beat rather than actually something that's genuinely trying to understand the pain that he was in and the frustration and the complexity of it in a way that Solaris, which I'm currently writing a big video about and that you completely like made me sort of like... because I'd never heard of like people talk about Solaris before. No one ever brings up George Clooney and Steven Soderbergh's Solaris. And the exploration of depression and mental health in that is almost overwhelming, and how much it pays attention to it. And in complete contrast, it felt like this film just needed him to be depressed and kill himself. Like, it didn't feel like it meant anything. Yeah. Didn't like it at all.
Jack, okay, so here's the thing. I think that you have done the straight to the heart of the periphery. I think it's just like the whole of everything that you've just said is like, I didn't see the film. Not I didn't watch the film. I watched it, but I didn't see it. Now, I am perfectly willing to accept that there are differences of opinions on this.
You've said straight to the heart of the periphery to me before.
Yeah, I know. And I think it's a talent that you have particularly. I am willing to accept that there are, you know, differences of opinions about the merits or otherwise of films. But let's just take this particular, the thing about Matt Dillon's depression isn't dealt with, okay?
Okay.
So Alison Anders had a conversation with Brian Wilson, because obviously, you know, Brian Wilson is behind that character, as of course, you know, Dennis Wilson. And if you are, as I am, a Beach Boys obsessive, and, you know, somebody who my great friend Matt O'Casey made a brilliant documentary about Dennis Wilson, and if you are interested in that particular, you know, what the story of Brian Wilson's creativity, and if you, for example, did you see Love and Mercy?
No.
Okay, so Love and Mercy, which is a film actually biographically about Brian Wilson, which is played over two periods, and is Paul Dano as the young Brian Wilson, and uncannily like Brian Wilson, and then John Cusack as the older Brian Wilson. And I'm a real Beach Boys fan, and I love the Wilson brothers story. And anyway, so Alison Anders talked to Brian Wilson about this and said, what do you think? And he said, well, you got some things right and you got some things wrong, but it all felt true. And I thought that that was just the most brilliant, brilliant story. And she came on the show. I was trying to get her to come on the MK3D show for ages, and she came on. They were showing Gas Food Lodging at the NFT. And we talked about the fact that the theremin player that she has on when he's doing the concept album thing actually turned out to be somebody who played on Good Vibrations. And I think that the from the soundtrack point of view, I think the way the songs are constructed, that they are those, you know, Jerry Goffin and Carole King compositions are brilliantly evoked, but never pastiched. I think you're the whole thing about the mother. I'm literally having to recall to myself, and I've seen this film a lot of times, how significant or insignificant that is. I think that if I'm being kind, and I'm going to be kind, Jack, because I like you.
Okay.
I think that it is possible that that film requires an investment in the period and the story and the stories around which it circles for it to fully work. But I have seen that film so many times, and I have never, never felt that it missed any of the beats in the way that you think it does. In fact, I think one of the things I love about it is that it feels like a tapestry, no pun intended, of so many stories, so beautifully interwoven, that the only surprise to me is that it came and went in a heartbeat and nobody paid it any attention at all. And then that thing you do, which I really like, I think it's a great film about one-hit wonders, much more captured people's attention because it was a simpler and easier to understand story. And it breaks my heart. My heart to hear you dislike it that much.
I don't think it is a complex story. I don't think there is. I think it's soap opery.
That you're going to have to take back. You're going to have to take back soap opera. I'll give you it's like somebody going seeing Raging Bull and going, "Yeah, but it's not as good as Rocky." You know, it's like but you know, that 2001, I mean, it's all right, but I mean,
it's not as good as Star Wars.
Well, Jack, I'm heartbroken. I'm heartbroken. I'm partly because I thought that would be the ace in the hole. I thought you'd love it, and I thought I'd have another friend to talk to about it. I mean,
Well, maybe you should just start to realize that maybe that's why no one wants to talk about it, is because it's not great. And I just think from the. Everything about it felt like...
Okay, stop. Okay.
Go on.
No, because I know... Okay, so you've completely shit-canned the film that I really, really love, and that's fine, and I have allowed you to
and
do
I,
it.
And I feel bad about
it. No, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine, you know. I'll get over it. And there's I, and I'm going, yeah, Mask of Zorro, yeah, it's fine, you know, yeah, you chose a TV movie for your number one, it's fine. I'm there and I'm like playing Mr. Benign, and then you just like, you come and you stab me in
good,
the back.
I've chosen
you just stab
movies.
Me in the back.
This felt like it was supposed to be a biopic, but wasn't. It felt like the story was written like very, and then. And I was like, is this a true story? Because it feels like it's being constructed like it's going, oh, we need to tell it in this order because this is how it happened.
But that's the point.
If it's inspired by real events.
It is. It's inspired by the story of Carole King, but it's not based on the story of Carole King. It's, you know, it is, it's a poetic reconstruction of a period. I mean, it's the story of the Brill Building as told through a character whose story intertwines with that of Carole King and that of the Wilsons and that of... Spectre and that of the changing nature of the music industry and you know, and I can't help it if you're a tone deaf teenager, it's, you know, there's nothing I can do about
it. Oh, we're getting
Jack.
To name calling now. I just think if it isn't inspired by an actual
it is inspired by an actual
it is, yes, but it feels like it's tying itself to the way that Bohemian Rhapsody, which, you know...
Don't you dare.
Split opinion.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare compare Grace of My Heart to Bohemian Rhapsody.
Look, Grace of My Heart feels like it was like tying itself, chaining itself to, we have to tell it in this order because this is how it happened in real life. When all the characters are fictional and you could have done what you wanted with them. And if you want to tell a story about Carole King, do a fucking biopic about Carole King. Like it just feels like it was like tying itself to a narrative it didn't need to. It felt like it was making the narrative more simpler and weirder and worse.
You
and,
know,
but
you've got a point. I mean, the thing is, you know, Hamlet, right? He just complains the whole time. And what they should have, somebody should have just said, Hamlet, snap the fuck out of it. You're young and fit and quite rich, so just knock it on the head. Anyway, Nick has reappeared on the video screen with a glum look on his face, which means, guys, you have to wrap this up because this has been going on for quite some time. So, but Jack, okay, so in the interest of friendly, here's what I'm going to say. If anybody hasn't seen Grace in My Heart, please go and see it and then let us know whether you are Team Jack or Team Mark. And
this is like Twilight all over again.
Exactly. And we'll do the Twilight movies next. And also, let me just say that contrary to popular opinion, it is perfectly possible to share completely conflicting opinions. And I have enjoyed battling with you over this.
It sounds really good, but you know the key to the song really is the build, and you can be dramatic as long as it's truthful. Okay.
Guys, I know there's a lot of chefs in the kitchen here. Let's just try and get a great take and groove. All right, let's start. Roll tape.
Oh, Larry, you're so manly.
Well, there we go. That was Jack Howard and me discussing our top two underrated films. If you want numbers 5 to 3, then just go back and listen to last week's podcast. It's available to download now, as indeed is the entire back catalogue of Kermode on Film podcasts. If you're interested in going a little deeper, then why not visit our Patreon page, which is full of exclusive extras and special video content. We're also starting to put up online an entire archive of all the Mark Kermode Live in 3D shows that are recorded at the BFI South Bank. And if you're interested in those shows, obviously we can't do them live at the South Bank at the moment, but they are continuing online. We did a great MK3D show live online on Tuesday. It's available to watch now on the BFI channel on YouTube. Thanks for watching. Stay safe, stay home, protect the NHS and save lives, and keep watching the skies.